Intersections is recorded, produced, and distributed on the territories that have been stolen from the Coast Salish nations of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. The members of the Gender Empowerment Collective seek to dwell within and reckon with these historical truths of dispossession and violence as we dream and curate conversation towards more whole worlds.
Good morning and welcome to Intersections as presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. We're here at CITR 109 FM, broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m., we host a panel with collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
Well, welcome back to Intersections, listeners. Today is our follow-up episode on gender and the law. Today, we're going to be talking about anti-trans and anti-gay legislation in the U.S. I'm Randy, the collective lead for the Gender Empowerment Collective.
Hi, and I'm Hal. I'm also a member of the Gender Empowerment Collective, and I'm really excited to be here today.
Yeah, and today we're joined by our special guest, Jessica Mason-Piclo. Hello, Jessica. How are you this morning?
Oh, hi. Thanks so much for having me. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
All right. So just to jump in, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Jessica, and the work that you do?
Sure. I am currently the SVP and executive editor of Rewire News Group. And Rewire News Group is the nation's only independent nonprofit media organization dedicated exclusively to covering reproductive and sexual health rights and justice issues. So as you might imagine, we are sort of at the forefront and center of the anti-choice, anti-trans, anti-LGBTQ legislation that is sweeping across the country. I am a former law professor, and I have written two books on the rights campaign to overturn Roe versus Wade. So I have been doing this for a little bit now.
Well, I'm super happy that we could get such an expert on the show. We're very happy about it. So I'm a lifetime fan of Boom Lawyered. I've been listening to Boom Lawyered for forever. I made a comment today that I was so excited. I took this interview over everyone else in the collective because I was like, I have to meet one of the coaches. So yeah, do you mind just like sharing for kind of my own selfish interest, like the history of Boom Lawyered, like how it came about? Yeah.
So Boom Lawyered is a podcast that I co-host with Amani Gandhi, and she is Angry Black Lady on Twitter. If you are not familiar, please make yourself familiar. She's probably one of the clearest voices on racial sexual justice issues right now. And really, everybody should be listening to what Amani has to say. But it's a podcast that has been in existence now for 5 years, which is wild to say out loud. We just crossed the 1 million downloads threshold, which is completely bananas. But Amani and I work together, but we really met on Twitter and became friends on Twitter as a result of the 2010 election that long ago, and the first real backlash cycle that we saw as a country to the election of the country's first black president. Amani and I started tracking anti-choice legislation together. We were both doing different things. She was in private practice. I was a law professor at the time. And then we just both like to talk. And so we thought maybe we should do a podcast about what's going on. And as lawyers, one of the things that has always been frustrating for both of us is how difficult the law is for everybody and how that's by design. That's anti-democratic. It's just wrong in so many levels, like morally, it's offensive to us. And so we set out with a mission to sort of democratize the law. in these very important ways for us, right? Like we cover a lot of civil rights issues. It's almost exclusively around reproductive justice issues, but we get into a host of other things as well because they're all kind of tied together. And, you know, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about the podcast for a little bit, because it is really special to us because it is a space that we do feel is, you know, really crucial for folks like you to, you know, and the folks who listen to this show who are obviously engaged and want to do more and want to learn more and don't have great resources available to them because the resources aren't out there, right? So what we try to do is really explain all of this crazy stuff that's happening in the law right now that's affecting us in very intimate and real ways, in ways that people can understand, not just to make us feel better, but so that they're empowered to then go into their communities and talk about it as well, because that's how change happens.
Yeah, I love that something so good can come from Twitter.
It's true. Some good can come from Twitter.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed, yeah, the expert of it, but also the appeal of, you know, discussing it in ways that everybody can understand. Like, I'll be so confused about something, I'll read news stories, and then I'm like, wait, I'm going to go listen to a Bloom Lawyered episode, and I think I'm going to understand it after that. So thank you.
That's like the best ad. We don't run ads on our podcast, but thank you. I might take that clip and run it as an ad for us. That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome to. So yeah, to jump into kind of our first question on this topic, we wanted to talk about this wave of anti-trans and anti-gay legislation kind of sweeping the US. So we noted the Georgia legislation to ban transgender children from sports and also the quote, "Don't Say Gay" bill in Florida. Can you explain to our listeners kind of what these bills will effectively do once they're placed into law? Just kind of, you know, elaborate more.
Sure. So the Georgia bill that you mentioned is similar to bills in other states across the country, like Missouri and Arkansas, for example. And what it does is it attempts to define into law our identity as based on biological sex, and then set that as a way to identify privileges and access to you know, facilities, you know, teams, you know, functionally moves out of the school, public schools, and into other public spheres. And so that's the Georgia bill. And then we've got the Florida bill, which is a variation, sort of like a, you know, parallel track of awfulness here, that is Don't Say Gay. And that is, you know, you will hear folks say that, well, that's really designed to get at, you know, not teaching, you know, a comprehensive sex ed curricula too early, or like any of these things, but it's really about erasing the identities of LGBTQ people in public education spaces. And I say that very specifically because I want to connect the dots of what is happening with these two pieces of legislation to the campaign by conservatives broadly to upend public education. These are all tied together. And so what they do is use these kinds of bills as a way to gin up support in their base and further go after other things. Because what's happening in those spaces comes at the same time, for example, that Governor Abbott in Texas says, you know what, we don't think people should be paying for, or that we don't think like free public education for immigrants is a thing that we have to do at all, even though the Supreme Court says we do. So it's all part and parcel of the same thing. And it's really this attack on our public education infrastructure. Why would they do that? Well, because it's empowering. When we have an educated population, we understand when we're being treated poorly, for example, and we don't like it very much, and we do things to change that, right? So it is really that nefarious. And in these places, they are playing off of people's biases against whatever, whether it's internalized homophobia, whether it's transphobia, or even just a misunderstanding of what those identities are and who we are. That's just, I mean, so that's sort of like the baseline. What we're seeing, though, is this is a national campaign. So it's not even authentic in the places that it's coming from. You know, there's a national organization I'll be Lions Defending Freedom, for example, that is out there pushing this. The Southern Poverty Law Center has identified them as a hate group for this very reason. And so even though we're seeing this sort of crop up, there's nothing organic about it at all.
Absolutely. And to follow up a little bit on the Florida bill, the wording of the bill claims that, quote, classroom instruction by school personnel or third parties on sexual orientation or gender identity will be limited. So these are fairly broad terms, sexual orientation and gender identity. And the definitions that conservative lawmakers use may be different than, for example, how queer activists identify themselves. So is there a more explicit defining of these terms in the bill, and how can we see it applied as a result?
So in terms of more explicit definitions in the bill, there's none that I am aware of unless some of that language has been updated. And given the last week and a half of news in the abortion space, it is entirely possible that there's a little bit that there's something that I'm overlooking. But what we need to understand about how this would be applied is always against, or I should say, always in a conservative bias, right? So what does it mean to instruct on gender identity at kindergarten? I mean, I understood all of my teachers to be cis and hetero because they talked about their families. They had pictures on their desks. Is that instruction? So I'm less worried about the vagaries around something like gender identity and you know, sexual orientation in the law than I am around what conservatives think instruction is, because we're hearing this rhetoric already around grooming, right? That just the very presence of LGBTQ people, of queer people in spaces, right? Just us being people in the world is grooming children. Because they are exposed to us. Like, that's the nugget of what they're saying. So, you know, to your point, I don't know that they define those terms anymore, but what alarms me as a lawyer and, you know, civil rights person in this space is how they will talk about what they think instruction means, right? Like, I don't know. That what do you think instruction means? You'd think it'd be like a curriculum, right? No, that doesn't
absolutely
exist.
Yeah,
I've got kids in, you know, who went through public education K through, you know, 12, and what conservatives say happens in schools doesn't happen in schools.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think a lot of people talk about children's books during this time, because even when I was growing up, we really didn't have diverse children's books, and now they're so much more accepting and so much more diverse, and these are starting to enter classrooms, and I know a lot of the conversations are these going to stay in classrooms? Mm-hmm. Are books as well, just casually in the classroom, not even part of the curriculum, going to be limited as well?
Yeah, I would expect so. I mean, we're seeing this, you know, again, in part and parcel with the anti-critical race theory conversations happening and all of the panic about removing books in instructional settings across the board. The argument conservatives make is that, you know, it's sort of that is a politicized way to be doing education. But it was always politicized. The absence of those stories, the absence of those identities is in fact a politicized education to begin with.
Yeah, for sure. So just following up again on the Don't Say Gay quote bill. Mm-hmm. So supporters of this bill have argued that parents should be in charge of discussing educating children about sexual orientation, gender identity, et cetera. However, this overlooks the concept that a lot of these children don't have parental guidance and support on these topics, mm-hmm. And further marginalized LGBTQ plus people in schools. So with that in mind, what do you think is most important for schools and families to be aware of when this bill is implemented?
Wow, that's an excellent question. Truly, I think, you know, when this bill is implemented, one of the things that they need to be, you know, focused on is that the reason we educate people to begin with is to empower and improve their outcomes. And when we fail to educate around just, you know, basics of self, that does real harm. And the, you know, the Trevor Project does wonderful work in documenting a lot of this, but we already know that without these targeted measures, public schools were a tough place for LGBTQ kids, a really tough place for trans kids. So I just want folks to know that those spaces are going to get more difficult, and we have to hold our community close and figure out ways to, you know, protect our kids and our families. I have friends of mine who are in Texas and have kids who identify as non-binary, and they're terrified right now. Families are really, really scared. And this isn't a hypothetical. This isn't, you know, a political debate. These are real people's lives that are at issue and on the line. And that's what worries me the most about this is, you know, I'm almost 50. I have lived and seen some things. And the backlash cycle that we are in feels reminiscent of other backlash cycles that got violent. You know, we went through a period of time in this country called the Lavender Purge, where we were effectively, you know, removing anybody in queer spaces in the LGBTQ community from public life. Like, it was not safe to be out. And that's what conservatives are tracking back towards. That's what they want. They even say so. And so, you know, one of the reasons, and, you know, Imani and I talk about this on the podcast, but it's really important to take folks at their word, even if that word is terrifying. And even if that word is like, I can't think about that possibility. We don't really have that luxury anymore, because there is a really emboldened conservative movement in this country that is anti-democratic. And all of these attacks on civil rights are at the forefront of it. That's how fascist regimes stay in power.
Yeah. I really like also just like following up a bit on that. Like, I really like in the last episode, your reaction episode, talking about the Alito. We'll get to that later in our interview. But I really liked at the end when you said, like, it's about care. Like, it's your work needs to be about care. You care about these people. You put these people first, because at the end of the day, these are people's lives.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we do care work. And that is, you know, this is fundamental human rights work. And fundamental human rights work is care work.
MRG Live presents Black Violin's Impossible Tour, live at the Vogue Theater on March 10th. Black Violin, the classically trained hip-hop duo, shatter cultural and musical stereotypes and bring an energetic show you don't want to miss. Tickets on sale now at admit1.com.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Absolutely. And you brought up the Lavender Purge, which is something we actually talked about fairly extensively in the last episode. We talked about the Lavender Scare. And the argument that I was making in that segment was kind of the idea that the Lavender Scare as a moral panic is a good tone for other moral panics that we see, and that generally moral panics can be a foundation for some of the most discriminatory legislation that we see in the states across history. So I want to ask your opinion if this current legislation counts as part of a moral panic, and if so, what the implications of that would be.
It does. You know, I will say that I go back and forth with the term moral panic, because there is something about it that bothers me in terms of putting a framing that even kind of feels like not supportive, but like, you know, acknowledging the validity of conservatives' discomfort with anything that doesn't, you know, sort of look, act, and sort of behave as them. But the point is absolutely correct. Yes. I mean, that is what this is about. And we can talk about it truly as moral panic among conservatives, because what are they panicking against? What are they panicking about? They're panicking about progress in its most fundamental sense. They're panicking about the fact that there has been, to some degree, racial progress, to some degree, progress on LGBTQ equality, right? That there has been some progress for women in managing economic improvements, not even like huge gains, right? Just progress, and they're losing their minds.
Yeah, and to that point, we often see this anti-trans, anti-queer legislation come out of the conservative Christian wing, and usually those justifications are explicitly religious. However, if you look to other religions, such as those of indigenous communities, the gender binary doesn't really exist. It's not present. So we wanted to ask if there is a potential religious freedom justification for saying this is restricting our religious freedom because our gender doesn't exist in a binary. Is there ever a countersuit to that in any way?
There is, except Boom Lawyer listeners will know what I'm about to say next. We have a federal judiciary that is stacked with bad judges appointed by conservatives who rule in bad faith ways and would not recognize that claim. So objectively, should one exist? Yes. Like objectively, there are people of Jewish faith who have a religious freedom argument for accessing abortion services. Would a federal court in this country recognize that? I am very skeptical. And that's just because of how the courts have been politicized, not because they're not valid and legitimate legal claims. They absolutely are.
So you mentioned this a bit, talking about the Georgia bill, but we just wanted to follow up if there's any other like anti-trans, anti-gay legislation. You mentioned like it's part of this like whole goal of like going against education, going against these rights. Is there any other distinct bills that our listeners should be aware of just to like keep an eye on in the news and everything?
Absolutely. So I mentioned this Texas nonsense a little briefly. What I would absolutely say is pay attention to the way that all of the attacks on public education and in K through 12 start to move now, because it will go in the direction of sliding for public education further and further into a religious space or an unattainable chartered private space. So as far as other specific bills, nothing's coming to mind, but also I've been really laser focused on the anti-abortion bills that have been coming through. And so one that I would highlight, just because I do think it's absolutely relevant, is, you know, in the wake of all of these ridiculous and very extreme, restrictions that are going through, Louisiana just advanced a bill that would charge a pregnant person with homicide if they have an abortion. The way that abortion is defined in the bill actually outlaws most forms of birth control, and it establishes a life at conception, which is fetal personhood, and therefore creates a whole host of criminal outcomes for people, possible criminal outcomes for people who are pregnant, should that pregnancy not end in a viable delivery to the state. So that is very alarming. For a long time, the anti-choice community, I didn't always believe them, but they said it, said, we're not going after pregnant and birthing people. We're not here to jail people who have babies or people who have abortions. And what they have proven is that they actually are.
Yeah, I like that you said you believed it. You fell for it. I used to do that too. When I first got into abortion activism, it was very difficult to like kind of weed through these arguments and really get to like the bottom of what they were truly, because they're very good at hiding it. They're very good at like throwing some fancy language behind it.
Yeah. And, you know, for a while, there were conservatives in the anti-abortion movement who didn't want to jail people who had abortions. They were truly trying to, you know, for whatever reason, not like they had it in their head that they were just, you know, saving a lot of people, babies, whatever. But they're, you know, the mask is off.
Yeah. So you've kind of talked about this concept of this like wider conservative movement against progressiveness in the US. So we wanted to just talk about like, it seems rare to us, well, to me in Canada, or not, sorry, to start over. It's not rare, as in I don't expect it to happen, but these civil rights are being rolled back like so decisively with these anti-trans, anti-gay, like these abortion bans, particularly rights that have been kind of embellished in the Constitution. So how did this come about? Have the foundations always been there for these laws to change, or is this truly like a sudden thing, what it feels like to like an outside perspective? Like as a Canadian looking at the US, it feels like in the last few months, all of these things have just like arisen, just like risen as like, is this giant tidal wave just coming out?
So I think it's both things, right? The reality is in this country, there has been an growing, and I don't mean by numbers necessarily, but growing in power, evangelical political movement that is, you know, the religious right, but it's functionally swallowed up the entirety of the Republican Party. And it's really also not representative of the majority of how people in this country identify politically. It is a minoritarian rule, functionally, is what we are living in large swatches of this country. And what do I mean by that? Well, we have, over the last, you know, two censuses that have dropped, gone through very politicized gerrymandering at the federal level, and even more so at the state level. And what this has done is rigged the system to the point of breaking it, so that in some places, it is impossible to actually elect Democratic and progressive leadership, even though the people who live in those districts absolutely want that kind of leadership. It is reflective of the moral values of the voters. So that's the slow burn of how we got here. The rapid escalation is also happening. And that has been, you know, that has also too been kind of incrementalized, but it really went off the chain as soon as Amy Coney Barrett was appointed to the Supreme Court in this country, because what that meant for conservatives was that they really now had a lock that could not be undone. It is a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court for whatever they want to do. And 6-3 is, you know, different than 5-4 in the court of public opinion for folks who don't pay attention that much, right? For folks who are like, I don't know, I thought Neil Gorsuch wasn't that bad of a guy. Like, there were a lot of seemingly reasonable legal journalists saying Neil Gorsuch isn't that bad of a guy. So if he's along, if he's part of the six, it can't be that bad. John Roberts seems pretty reasonable. If he's part of the six, it can't be that bad. Like, that's the you know, what conservatives have done really well is sort of play the court of public opinion that way. And so, you know, what they know is there's nothing to stop them. Like the leaked Alito memo shows that they're doing everything they can, and it's functionally their response is, well, who's going to stop us? What are you going to do? And absolutely, honestly, like, what are Democrats doing? I don't know.
Yeah, and on that note, as someone who is from the States, I think the narrative very much was vote for Biden, get Democrats in office, and then you can just have peace. And even if the Supreme Court is stacked, you can just have peace. You don't have to pay as much attention as an average person. And I think a lot of us probably believe that.
Yeah.
And now it's... Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I got all excited. You go ahead.
Well, a lot of the legislation we're seeing right now is coming about in the Biden presidency and during a time for the first time in nearly a decade when Democrats mm-hmm. have both the House and the Senate.
Yeah.
So why do you think that this is coming about? Is it just the Supreme Court, or are there kind of deeper social implications to what's going on?
Yeah. So, a couple of things. What I was getting really excited about was I think that there was legitimately in this country a sigh of relief that there wasn't a second Trump term. And for a lot of us, real trauma surviving the first one. And so just the opportunity to like take a breath felt really good. And I don't want people to feel bad if they were like, oh, thank God, at least that guy's not in office anymore, right? Like, that's real. People have bandwidth issues when we are in this like onslaught of disaster after disaster after disaster. We need to recognize that, you know. But then two things are going on. There's a Democratic administration at the federal level, but that's not reflective of what's happening in the states for a lot of the reasons that I just suggested. So like all of these bills that we're seeing come out of states, those are, you know, from Republican administrations across the board. The Biden administration has not done a whole lot in terms of response. I will give them credit on a few points, though. Alabama has one of these horrible anti-trans felony healthcare ban bills, basically, right? Like it's a felony to provide gender-affirming healthcare to kids. The Biden administration has just, as of last week, filed a petition with the court there to jump in and go after that bill. So to put the full force of the federal government behind going after this bill. This is the first time we've seen that. So there is hope there that they will respond in kind also to Georgia's bill, to Florida's bill and whatnot, and start moving, because that's what they can do. We need to be upset with the Democrats in the Senate. So like the Biden administration is, you know, they're doing one thing, but the Democrats in the Senate can't get a dang thing done. And those are the folks who we need to be upset with. We could have protections for abortion rights passed right now, right? We could have the Women's Health Protection Act signed by Joe Biden right now, but there are two Democrats who won't get on board with that. And, you know, can't do anything about them, apparently, right? We could have passed the Equality Act, which would have protected LGBTQ folks at the federal level, except there are two Democrats who can't get on board with that. So, you know, while I'm frustrated with Joe Biden and he was not my choice in terms of who I would have elected as Democratic president, I am really saving most of my fire for Senate Democrats who can't seem to do the very basic job that they were elected and are squandering this moment when if we lose the Senate, right? If Democrats lose the Senate and if Democrats lose control of the House and we have another Republican president, we already know, for example, what they're doing. They're telling us they're looking for a nationwide 6-week abortion ban. We know they are going after legislation that would remove the employment protections for LGBTQ people that the Bostock decision granted just a couple years ago. We know they're going for a case that would overturn Obergefell v. Hodges, the Supreme Court decision that guaranteed marriage equality and opened the door for additional legal protections. We don't have to guess about that. They've told us that. They've told us that. So we should be mad the Democrats in the Senate don't seem to be alarmed.
Absolutely. And last election, we had, correct me if I'm wrong, record voter turnout because everybody was very concerned about another Trump presidency. And now we're going into a very important midterm when Democrats in the Senate aren't handling this correctly. Do you think that could have an impact on voter enthusiasm?
I do. I worry. I mean, I'm not sleeping great these days, if I'm being honest. I do. You know, I mean, you got to deliver for your constituents. And there are a lot of things that have floundered. And, you know, I mean, the Biden administration has done some good things, but I do think it's fair to be like, we should be using the power that the voters gave you. You know, Republicans are never afraid to wield their power. I don't know why Democrats are.
Absolutely. So at this point, we wanted to move on to talking about Alito's leaked opinion. So at the point we're recording this, this was leaked a few days ago. Things are still developing. They may change within the next week or so. However, many of the recent trans healthcare bills, as well as his opinion, have more important implications. I feel like you've touched upon a lot regarding rights to privacy, rights to marriage equality, things like that. And for me personally, as a queer person living in the States, marriage equality is something that is very important and is very scary right now. So can you talk a little bit more about what the implications may be on that?
Sure. So for your listeners who, you know, may or may not know, the right to abortion is one of a host of sexual privacy rights that the Constitution protects. It protects the right to contraception, whether you're single or married, for example. It protects the right to not be prosecuted by the state for engaging in sodomy, for example. Lots of things that it protects. It was also the basis for the court recognizing marriage equality because, and get into some of the legal history there, you know, but truly you just don't you know, if you believe in equality, then you don't create systems where the government can preference one kind of marriage over another based on a religious belief, right? And that is the opposition to marriage equality is fundamentally a religious opposition, as conservatives have consistently doubled down and told us so. In the leaked draft opinion that overturns Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, Justice Alito does not stop there. He does not say that this is a case that's about abortion, and so we're only going to talk about abortion. His draft opinion goes after the entirety of sexual privacy rights. He completely ignores the Ninth Amendment, which guarantees those rights, and instead does this like really tortured analysis about how the Constitution doesn't really, you know, protect things unless there's this deeply rooted historical tradition to do so. That should alarm everyone who is not a white man who owns property in this country, because those were the only people who were originally protected in the Constitution. The decision makes it very clear that as far as Alito and the conservatives are concerned, that not only was Roe an egregious wrong, but Obergefell was an egregious wrong that needs to be addressed. And he doesn't say it like as boldly as I said it, but it's there. And that, you know, and so your listeners should know, for example, that there are states that never took laws off the books that discriminated against same-sex married couples, for example. There are states that never took sodomy bans off of their books, for example. The state of Texas has still, you know, on its books a law that says functionally we can opt out of performing same-sex marriages if we want to. I predict that we will see Greg Abbott in the state of Texas move on that after this Dobbs decision is dropped. They want to undermine these institutions, and we can't, like, I don't want to sound, I know I sound alarmist, but this is an alarming time. People need to understand that you know, they don't care. I have, you know, people who are in my family very much affected by this and still don't want to believe it. And I'm like shaking everybody like as much as I can to say, no, truly. During the Ketanji Brown Jackson confirmation hearing, Senator John Cornyn, senator from Texas, did an entire rant about how marriages have a religious history in this country. That is speaking to Sam Alito's dissent, or to his draft opinion that we saw, right? That is, they're talking to each other, not, you know, like specifically, but like, you know, they're vibing, right? That's what the kids say. Like, that's what's happening. They're setting that argument up. They want the court to recognize marriage as a religious institution, which was John Roberts' dissent in the Obergefell case, and to build on that. That's how they're moving the law.
Yeah. I really like how you said, like, I don't want to sound alarmist, but this is an alarming time. And I think that just is such an important, like, part of this work and these, like understanding these rights and these, you know, these liberties. Like, it's like, you shouldn't be alarmist and you shouldn't lose hope, but at the same time, you should be, you know, you should always have that little bit of worry in the back of your mind. That's like, and I think I'm working on a show right now about abortion in Canada, very much inspired by Boom Lawyered, because I was like, hey, we need to talk about this in Canada. And that's one thing I talk to a lot of activists about, you know, abortion rights in Canada. And obviously it's a very different picture than the US, but there are some similarities we can draw. And that's one thing that I said, like, a lot of people are just a bit too comfortable in Canada. They're a bit too comfortable that we're okay, we're fine, you know, nothing bad is going to happen. But we, in fact, have over 80, you know, conservative MPs that are very firmly against abortion rights. Like,
I was seeing something on Twitter, speaking of Canada and abortion, about Prince Edward Island and how, like, it was functionally impossible to get access because the, you know, lawmakers there were like, meh, we're not going to really like deal with the regulations. And all of the healthcare providers were pretty conservative. So they're like, man, we're not really interested in providing access. So there wasn't an abortion ban on the books.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get one.
Yeah, exactly.
Still couldn't get one.
And like in a lot of places, like the same as the US, we struggle with so much access issues. Like in Alberta, in southern Alberta, you have to drive at least 3 hours, mm-hmm. depending where you live, to get an abortion. Like that is not access to healthcare. Yeah. So yeah, I really try to push that to people when I explain to people, my friends and family, because I talk about this all the time. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to alarm you, but also, you know, be worried, like be concerned. Yeah. Like this is a right that could be taken away from you. Don't get too comfortable. This was great. I mean, do you have any final thoughts that you want to get, like, leave our listeners with, leave us with?
Yeah. These are really difficult and dark times, but we all have a lane. Everybody here has a lane. We all have a way that we can contribute, that we can help, that we can uplift, and we can hold our communities close. So don't try to do everything. Just figure out what your lane is and do that. And that is enough.
And those are fantastic words to leave us on. Thank you so much for coming on our show today. This conversation, I know both Hal and I enjoyed this so much.
Oh, it was an absolute delight. Thanks so much for asking.
Paul Jacobs, former member of Pottery, plays Wise Hall on May 26th. New music on the way this April. Tickets for his solo show are now on sale.
Tune in to Too Dreamy, Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR, featuring music from local female and non-binary musicians and some sweet bedroom pop tunes.
Hello, my name is Cora. I am part of the Michelle Band out of Edmonton, but I was born on Musanic lands in Victoria. And we're here to do an interview on Indigenous Law with Patricia Barkaskas.
Perfect. And I'm Bella. I am not part of the Indigenous community, but I am very interested in learning more about it and the nuance that I've never experienced in my life. So I'd like to introduce our guest. And first, I would like you to please kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and what your practice entails.
Will do. Tanashiki Oau, Patricia Barkaskas Dishinikashan. I am Métis and I'm from Alberta originally, but I've been living here on the unceded ancestral traditional territories of the Coast Salish people, specifically Musqueam, Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh Nations for about 18 years. And I acknowledge that I'm an uninvited guest on these lands. Yeah, in the work that I do at the University of British Columbia at the Peter A. Allard School of Law, which of course is located, the law school itself is located on Musqueam territory at the university. I have worked for many years as the academic director at the Indigenous Community Legal Clinic, which is located in the downtown east side and which serves the Indigenous community, not just in the downtown east side, but all through the lower mainland and indeed throughout BC. We've got clients there that we represent who are from all over this province. So I'm a legal educator and a lawyer. And in my role at the ICLC, my job is to direct the overall pedagogy of the clinical program and also to supervise students who are running files specifically in both Aboriginal law, which is really where Indigenous folks come in contact with the Canadian legal system. And then also, of course, trying to bring in and incorporate through Indigenization and decolonization, Indigenous laws or Indigenous legal issues through that process too. So the clinic itself is a program that invites up to 10 law students per term to come and spend a full-time term at the clinic representing our clients. So under the supervision of myself and a few other supervising lawyers, they run the files themselves and actually engage in that work one-on-one with the clients and represent them in their legal matters. I suppose I should say that currently I'm away from the clinic because I've stepped into the role of Director of Indigenous Legal Studies at the law school. So I'm administrating sort of programming overall at this point. yeah, that's been, it's been a nice change in the sense that, you know, it's, the clinic is a lot of work, not that the administrative work isn't a lot of work too, but definitely there's a little bit of a shift there, so.
Perfect, that's really interesting. But just to follow up, I kind of wanted to know a little bit more about how you wound up getting into law, or especially studying specifically Indigenous law.
Yeah, so I mean, as an Indigenous person, I think looking at law and policy in terms of state and Indigenous nation interactions has always been of interest to me. In my undergraduate and then my master's work, I certainly focused on that, especially in the work of Indigenous feminists and the powerful and important work that they've done to make change in various ways, including, for example, to the status provisions under the Indian Act. So really what happened was I did my master's degree. I finished my undergrad at University of Victoria and the lands of the Lekwungen speaking folks and nations over there. And then I came to Vancouver to UBC to do my master's. And I really focused in on Indigenous women's political and legal activism for my master's degree, specifically looking at the Indian Homemakers Association work. Following that, I was invited to apply for a contract to work doing legal historical research for the Indian schools residential settlement process. And I got that position and started doing the work and realized very quickly that working inside of the belly of the beast, as it were, doing that work, even though I was doing good work for claimants in helping them get their residential school settlements through the CEP or Common Experience Payment process at that point in time, I really didn't feel like the way that the system was functioning, the settlement agreement from the inside, seemed like a very racist colonial process, which indeed I still hold that it is and was. I understand, of course, the importance of it and the significance of it to residential school survivors, and I myself am an intergenerational survivor of residential schools. But what was happening behind those doors was really awful in a lot of ways. So as that contract started to wind down and I was invited to reapply for a new contract, I really made the decision sort of on a whim to write the LSAT and apply to law school. I knew the settlement agreement was going to be going on for a long time, and I wanted to be on the other side of it, representing people in their interactions with Canada on that settlement process. So that's what I did. I applied to law school, I wrote the LSAT, and then I got in. So I was sort of like, oh, okay, well, I guess this is happening now. And, you know, other than thinking about the residential school settlement and representing people for that, I didn't intend to practice law, frankly. I intended to help people with the settlement when I came out of law school, or through law school at the clinic that I now direct. Which I took in my second year and did some of that work. But I didn't intend to go into practice and become a lawyer. I really wanted to go into policy work or back into academia, because I felt like you could really make significant change in those ways, systemically, right? Representing individuals is one piece of the puzzle, but systemic change is really where my focus has always been. So, but when I did the clinic, that the Indigenous Community Legal Clinic, and it was called the First Nations Legal Clinic at the time, I fell in love with court. I fell in love with litigating. I fell in love with advocating for those folks in the courtroom to people who really had no idea about the history of colonialism and why these Indigenous people were dealing with encounters with the Canadian legal system in the way that they were. And so that piece around educating others, educating lawyers and educating judges, educating the court and the system in that way became something that I became very passionate about. So decided to article and then practice before kind of coming full circle back to the clinic work and the work at UBC.
It sounds like you had a really incredible journey getting to where you are now. To kind of like continue off of that, you talk about on your website your interest in the intersection of justice and law. What does that mean to you, and like how are you enacting it as you've been moving through all of these systems?
Yeah, so I guess the first piece of the answer to that is that I don't think about law and justice as being being in a relationship really at this point, right? I think about law as being something that exists that actually creates injustice, especially in the lives of Indigenous people. And, you know, I use this expression a lot. It's from Hadley Friedland's work at the University of Alberta, which is intergenerational injustice. And that's really when we're talking about, to me, law and the Canadian legal system, what we have for Indigenous peoples is intergenerational injustice. So when I talk about the intersection of law and justice, I'm really talking about how we can change law to actually bring justice into focus and to bring justice into the law. And part of the way that I focus on doing that is by disrupting, intervening in, or in fact, trying to completely change what I call the normative violence of legal education. Because the way that people are educated in law school is the beginning of a process whereby they become very comfortable with the idea that law and justice are not the same thing and don't have a relationship. So the dismantling of that, or the assumption somehow that justice is built into law, is a really important part of that conversation to me. And when I think about Indigenous law in particular, or Indigenous folks who are encountering the Canadian legal system and the idea of justice, I think about it in two ways, right? So there's how do we think about making the Canadian legal system actually think about or incorporate justice into its practices and policies and legislation? And then there's also, what do Indigenous laws bring to the Canadian system in terms of either educating it about what justice really is and can be, or about how the Canadian legal system actually isn't appropriate at all because it does not incorporate justice. And especially for, like, through Indigenous law. So that's sort of the holistic answer to that question.
Yeah, you really touch on things that I personally care about through the medical system. I primarily focus on psychology and developmental psychology specifically, and the consequence that our medical system has on Indigenous bodies and how that's changing their developmental outcomes. So this is very much my speed, and I really appreciate you coming to us. And to follow that, I'd like to know how you envision Indigenous justice taking place in Canada.
Yeah, so my first part of the answer to that is I don't, and I'll contextualize that in a couple different ways. First, it's really just not up to me, right? Like, you know, and I'm not being glib. I mean it. Right? Obviously, each nation, each Indigenous nation, and the folks within that nation need to figure out what Indigenous justice looks like for them. Right? And it needs to be a distinctions-based process. We can't pan and indigenize approaches to justice for Indigenous folks and for different nations. And, you know, frankly, we're not going to see that in Canada unless we have self-determination, sovereignty truly, and land back, right? So the ways in which justice can function for Indigenous nations and Indigenous laws can function need to happen on the ground within communities themselves. So I don't think that it can't happen, but I think we're looking at a long process, right? And we see it happening in pieces and bits and drips and drabs here and there, right? In terms of the Canadian legal system kind of stepping back and allowing for some indigenization and decolonization in certain contexts. We see it a bit in nations taking over their own legal processes, of course, which is amazing. And then we see the tensions around that, right? The very real tensions within communities themselves about what are our laws and what does justice mean to us. And again, that's not for me to comment on because I'm not part of those communities. If I'm not part of those communities, that's not my, it's none of my business in so many ways, unless somebody invites me to participate somehow. And, you know, that's not an easy way out. It's truly about recognizing the sovereignty and the self-determination of those nations and acknowledging that just as much as any other nation, you know, for example, Canada, people are going to have different opinions, different perspectives, and there's going to be tension and stuff that needs to be worked out on the ground. So I think that if we acknowledge, if we truly are acknowledging what it means to have justice in Indigenous communities and to think about Indigenous laws functioning and being revitalized, then we have to support in every way possible self-determination, sovereignty, and land back.
Yeah, absolutely. My nation is currently going through the process of getting our land back and getting disenfranchised, I guess legally is the phrase. And that obviously isn't the same problem for every nation across all of Canada. Like, that's just our specific thing that we're going through. Let's continue. Okay. The Allard website also mentions that you've written Galdu reports for all court levels in BC. Can you talk a little to that?
Yeah. So first of all, maybe I'll tell people what Galdu reports are. So revisions to the criminal code back in the 1990s introduced section 718.2e, which is the provision in sentencing that indicates that courts must consider all alternatives to incarceration, specifically when looking at Indigenous people. They must take into account any and all possibilities that are alternatives to incarceration. So that provision was first really brought to bear through a Supreme Court of Canada decision called Regina and Gladue. Cindy Gladue is a Métis Cree woman who had killed her common law partner. And she pled guilty to manslaughter. And in that guilty plea, the trial judge did not take into account that new provision of the criminal code. So the case went up to the Supreme Court of Canada, who considered what that provision meant. And over time, it's come to be known as the Gladue provision or Gladue rights, or, well, in this case, we're talking about Gladue reports. But, you know, in a report that I co-wrote with several other people for the International Center for Criminal Law Reform, you know, one of the things that we note at the beginning of that is that to call this Gladue and to constantly be re-invoking Cindy Gladue's name in a way that that only brings her to bear on this one, on this case and this terrible thing that happened to her, is really problematic. So I acknowledge that while we refer to this all under the name Gladue, that that's a really problematic and we should change that at some point. However, ubiquitously, that's what it's called, and that's what we do in criminal law, is call it that. So Gladue reports are what the Supreme Court of Canada called, first in that case, and then in a later case where they revisited Gladue principles, the case of Ipoly and Ladue, they actually indicate that judges must consider the context of colonialism when they are sentencing Indigenous peoples. And in doing that, the courts may refer to a specialized pre-sentence report, which has come to be called the Gladue Report. So Gladue reports basically set out the history of a person's life, their community's history, their family's history, and what impacts over time that intergenerational injustice that we've talked about has had on them and why they are involved with the Canadian legal system. Very importantly, the other thing that a Gladue report does is not only provide that fulsome context, but also discusses the alternatives to incarceration piece. What is the healing plan for this person going forward? What resources exist for them to utilize that would allow them to pursue a sentence that was not incarceration? Now, unfortunately, the reality of that piece is that there aren't a lot of alternatives to incarceration out there, period, right? Resources have not been properly allocated to, and I'm going to, you know, go back to Indigenous communities themselves here, to Indigenous communities to figure out what it is that they want to do around resourcing, what alternatives to incarceration look like for their people. And even within the Canadian system, there aren't a lot of alternatives to incarceration. So we have this idea that there's an option out there for folks who might otherwise, you know, be going to jail to do something different or have a different sentence. And yet judges across this country have reported that they don't have options because resources don't exist, because there aren't places to send people or ways to set up sentences that aren't jail sentences. Another important thing to think about and really note about GLADU reports is that they're specialized report and they're written by GLADU report writers. So I'm a GLADU report writer, although I haven't written a GLADU report in quite some time, I can say. But those reports are not pieces of advocacy. Importantly, they are a litany of facts about a person's life, and then they are suggestions around their healing plan going forward. But the work of advocating for a sentence outside of incarceration and really contextualizing the pieces around that person's life and colonialism and intergenerational injustice are the job of the lawyer. And the Supreme Court of Canada has said very clearly that it is the responsibility of not just defense counsel, but also Crown Counsel and the judge themselves to make sure all this information comes before the court and is considered. So anytime that's not happening, when you have an Indigenous person before the Canadian legal system, and I say legal system in general, because I think GLADU applies across contexts in the legal system. I don't think at this point it's just, it's really just for criminal court, and people can argue with me about that. I'm happy for them too, but I can definitely say that I think we've reached a point where we're looking at that context across the Canadian legal system at all levels. But at the end of the day, you know, again, the Canadian system just doesn't have the supports there, and Indigenous communities don't have the resourcing to create the supports themselves in lots of cases. In some cases, there's always exceptions to that for sure. But that's what GLADU reports are and what they do.
Thank you. That's really interesting. I had no idea kind of, you know, about the nature of that and how important that can be, but.
Join Rock Sensations Me Without You as they bid farewell at the Hollywood Theater on May 18th. Visit hollywoodtheater.ca for more information.
Hey, what's wrong?
I want to go to therapy, but I can't afford it.
Well, did you know there's a show on CITR where you can get free therapy every other week?
Really? What's it called?
It's called Therapy Hour, and it airs every other Tuesday at 6 p.m.
You mean I can get free therapy every 2 weeks just by listening to the radio?
That's right. And it doesn't even cost you a dime.
Wow, I won't have to cry anymore.
Actually, crying is pretty good for you. I learned that by listening to Therapy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, because everyone needs therapy.
But not everyone can afford it.
Something that I talked about in our most recent episode was about the over-incarceration of Indigenous people, and specifically Indigenous women. It's something I learned about in one of my classes this year, and I was very, very interested in it. So I kind of have a two-parter question to ask you about it. I first wanted to know how you think that affects, or if it affects at all, your work in Indigenous law. And then with regards to some of the proposed solutions, I specifically discussed like the mandatory minimum sentence and kind of the proposed legislation to overturn that or to change that. I don't know, do you think those will be carried out? Do you think that it will help? I just kind of want to know your opinion on it.
Yeah. So to your first point, you know, I think that what's happening for Indigenous women in this country is a continuation of something that's been happening for a long time, right? And that has everything to do with the combination of colonialism, white supremacy, sexism, misogyny, right? And you know, I want to sort of open up the category here when we talk about this, and not just say women, but also gender diverse, gender non-conforming, and two-spirit folks, because it's happening for them too, in a way that isn't the same as it is for Indigenous men. And that's not to say that Indigenous men aren't suffering horribly and intergenerational injustice has not impacted them. Of course it has, but Indigenous women and gender diverse, non-conforming, and two-spirit folks have faced much more discrimination under Canadian policy and law than Indigenous men have. And that is always, that's a bit of a point of tension, right, that we have to contend with and actually really grapple with. So the reasons that things are getting worse for Indigenous women, you know, has a lot to do with the fact that within the Canadian legal system, again, they face multiple barriers and discriminations that are different from Indigenous men. And they also bear the burden, of course, of, you know, in many cases, being the caregivers to their children alone, without community and without potentially the other parent of that children, those children. And lots of times that's because they've been forced to leave community. And that has to do with the gender discrimination within the Indian Act, and that happening over generations. So Indigenous generations of Indigenous women find themselves not in their home communities and without those family and community supports. And in many cases, when Indigenous women come before specifically the criminal legal system, one of the things that they are faced with is the loss of their children. And so they will often plead guilty, even if they are not guilty, in order to make that process go faster, because the waiting time and the conditions around which they will have to be probably incarcerated whilst awaiting a trial are things that prolong the process of them being away from their children, right? So if they can get a sentence, if they can get into sentencing court, get their sentence dealt with, do their time and get out and get their children back, that is what they're going to prioritize over everything else. And unfortunately, we know it often doesn't go that way, right? If they plead guilty, they often will not get their children back, and they will end up in a situation where the grief and the heartbreak and of that separation and what they know is happening to their children within the Canadian child welfare system is something that then causes them to, you know, to really deteriorate themselves, right? And so they find themselves often criminalized, let's start there, and involved again before the criminal legal system, and it becomes a cycle. And then those children, of course, who are in the Canadian child welfare system are having the same horrible experiences, again, intergenerational injustice that their parents and grandparents, you know, often great grandparents, et cetera, have had. And that ends up with them being criminalized and involved in the criminal legal system. And we just see this over and over and over. So Indigenous women plead guilty more, almost always, whereas Indigenous men don't. Indigenous women, like I said, often prioritize the idea that they can get through the system faster by pleading guilty. They don't use GLADU reports as a result in sentencing too, because those take time. And often they're just trying to get it all over and done with as quick as possible. So they are bearing the burden in a disproportionate way of colonialism and the impacts of it. And that's finding them incarcerated. And then again, the often the alternatives to incarceration that do exist, even if they do get a GLAAD report and they do get a healing plan that looks at that, there aren't many supports for women, right? So a lot of the supports that are out there are in men's programming. So again, disproportionately, they don't have the same opportunities, even when they do look at alternatives to incarceration. So I'm not sure if that fully answers your question, but we can revisit pieces of it if you want.
I think that answers our question like incredibly well. I also saw this play out in my own hometown. One of my friend's moms was given a false plea bargain, I think is the word, where they're like, oh, if you plead guilty, we'll give you the minimum sentencing. She did not get the minimum sentencing, and my friend wound up in the foster system. I forgot the word foster for a hot minute there. So I definitely have seen this play out in my own community, and it is a really nasty thing. This is kind of tangentially related, but I'm sure you heard about the Indigenous grandfather and granddaughter who were arrested, the BMO bank.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear like how that played out legally in your opinion, and like how this ties into all of this.
And maybe I'll answer that question, and I'll come back very quickly to mandatory minimums, because I think that's the piece of the answer that I missed in the other question. So with that case, you know, I think that we have a number of different things going on. Obviously, the blatant discrimination that they experienced was unconscionable. You know, we are seeing changes to the human rights regime here in British Columbia. Indigeneity has been added as a grounds within our human rights code. And that was because of work that came out of the Expanding Our Vision report written by now Justice Ardith Whalcomb. And the importance of that and the significance of it unrecognized, but I don't know why, where my brain went, but I think that we're going to see more cases like that, right? More cases where people experience something that Indigenous people experience all the time. You know, we often refer to this kind of discrimination that happens to Indigenous folks as a micro discrimination, a micro aggression, though there's nothing micro about it. It's just called that because it happens all the time, right? So the idea of like shopping while Indigenous, being targeted just because you look Indigenous, or because you show symbols that indicate to folks that you might be Indigenous. That makes them think that you're sketchy and should be followed around a store, or that you shouldn't be able to open a bank account, or that you don't deserve medical services in the same way. On and on it goes, right? So, so in that case, one of the things that I think that came out of it that was really good, well, first of all, the publicity around it, right? And I really think that Angela Sterrett's work talking about this case, for the CBC and other news outlets is really important. And she's an incredible Indigenous journalist and really does a ton of work bringing to light these issues in the community. So huge gratitude to her for doing that work all the time. And the other thing that I wanna say about it is just that one of the, you know, not, I guess I always struggle to talk about these things as though we should focus on, you know, how positive things came out of them, because what happened to that, you know, what happened to that grandfather and his granddaughter is beyond horrible, right? It's dehumanization, right? It's a complete lack of acknowledgement of their dignity and respect for them as human beings. So that can't be emphasized enough. But at the same time, part of the end process that's come out of that is that it's going to the community, right? That the community has had an opportunity to weigh in on it, and that there's going to be a resolution in an Indigenous laws context through what the community and that nation considers to be an appropriate way to deal with this issue. And that's huge, right? It's huge that this particular story, this particular incident, this awful, terrible example of colonialism and racism is having an end result in Indigenous laws and an Indigenous legal process. So that's pretty phenomenal in terms of thinking about justice. And then just very quickly to return to mandatory minimums. Yeah, they're terrible. They need to go, period, end of story. They give judges no discretion. And if we're going to see justice at all, we must have discretion in our legal system. Judges must be able to make the decisions they need to make, and mandatory minimums do not allow for that. So they definitely need to go. You know, I'm also, I'll be frank, I'm an abolitionist. I don't believe in prisons. I practiced prison law and saw from the inside how horrible they are, and the fact that they make people's lives worse, Indigenous people's lives, obviously, but everyone, anyone who goes to jail has, their life is made worse by it, and no good comes of it, frankly. So we live in a strange and archaic system, as far as I'm concerned, around the way that we deal with people who have transgressed the law, right? Just one person's opinion.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree that prisons have no place in a humane society. It happened a lot, again, in my hometown, that someone would wind up in jail, and then they just wind up in jail. There's no escaping it, and it happens so easily. Okay, so I want to know a little bit what you think about precedent-based law and how that might be, it can be used to further Indigenous rights and Indigenous justice, but I personally feel that precedent-based law also holds us back a little bit. And I want to know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a double-edged sword. Absolutely. So precedent can 100% be the reason why judges make safe decisions, right? Decisions that don't contravene tradition or don't step outside of the parameters of decisions that have been made before them in precedent. And precedent also allows us to change law in really significant ways. So I've been involved in a few precedent setting cases around Indigenous folks and sentencing. And I can say that they are extremely important, right? When we can shift precedent, we have an opportunity to, again, think about actually bringing justice in some way, or at least threads of it. So I think when we think about precedent, one of the things that we need to think about is that it's not, precedent doesn't mean doctrine, right? We can transgress precedent, or we can set new precedent. It gives lawyers, and I say this to our law students all the time, a real opportunity to change the law, right? It is what allows us to find the hairline fractures of justice within a system that is about injustice, in my opinion, and follow those hairline fractures, or chip at them until they break open. So it does allow for real creativity, and some really incredible advocacy and the opportunity to make new law. So double-edged sword.
Perfect. Thank you. I really appreciate that. But just like that, we're pretty much out of time. So before we wrap up, I was just going to ask if you had any kind of closing thoughts or messages you wanted to share. And then if you could also give the listeners a good idea of where they can find you and where they can hear more from you.
Sure. So first of all, you can find me, you know, on the Ballard Law website. Obviously, I'm there. You can get a hold of me by email at barkaskas@allard.ubc.ca. My cell phone is also, you know, unfortunately widely available out there in the world because I've been a lawyer and I am a lawyer. So really not hard to find me if you really want to. Happy to talk to folks, indeed. But at the end of the day, closing thoughts would be, I think anyone who really cares about justice, and there are lots of ways to move forward in the world when you care about justice to make change, for sure, but should stop and at least think about going to law school. Because the more people that we have going to law school and becoming lawyers or judges, you know, or working in law adjacent professions and government changing policy, really being able to think about and consider the way that our legal system impacts people's lives across all kinds of contexts, and what you can do about it and the change that you can make. Anyway, I just think that it's a really powerful tool, right? And it opens a lot of doors in a lot of different ways. And I wish it was more accessible in terms of affordability, that's for sure. But I think that the ways that people can really use the law to make change is important. So I would encourage everybody to at least think about it, or, you know, do in your studies somewhere along the way, maybe law adjacent cases or. But learning about law and policy is really important because it really does impact the way our society functions, and therefore the way that injustice works and the opportunities to actually engage in creating a just society.
Perfect. Thank you so much again for your time. Cora, if you have anything else to say. All right. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
For listening to Intersections, presented by CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective at 101.9 FM. We can always be reached by email at genderempowerment@citr.ca or on Instagram at @gender_CITR for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. You can find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Our theme song is provided by John Allison Weiss. Tune in again in 2 weeks on Tuesday at 10 a.m. to catch our next episode.